It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. The U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the Wolf administration's plan to distribute more than $1 billion to help feed Pennsylvania families with school-aged children. Many of those kids would have received free and reduced-price lunch from school, and parents have shouldered the cost. While hunger existed before the pandemic, the need for access to quality, affordable food was brought into the spotlight. Dawn Plummer is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Food Policy Council. She joins us now.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Dawn, what is the state of hunger in the Pittsburgh area? Approximately how many people are hungry?
So we know that hunger was always a persistent issue nationally, including in our region. The pandemic has had a significant impact on hunger and food insecurity in our region. The rate is now up to 15.4%, which is a 42% increase from the most recent estimates in 2018. And these are data from Feeding America, which is a leading anti-hunger organization.
Up 42%.
You know, that increase is due to the pandemic itself and the economic fallout connected to the pandemic. Those rates are much higher for children. The impact of food insecurity is significant because children, as you mentioned, who qualify for free or reduced price lunches are largely not attending, you know, those who are still not attending in-person school. Schools have been able to quickly, you know, alter the way they deliver meals through grab-and-go sites. But, you know, the accessibility of those sites and the ability of families to pick up those meals has dropped significantly. I know in Pittsburgh Public Schools, there are over 20,000 students who eat meals every day, and that there are only, you know, a few thousand of those lunches being picked up. There have been pandemic EBT funds distributed to families, which has helped to fill that gap. But I think that that school piece is really central to the rise in food insecurity among children.
When we say someone is hungry or when someone is food insecure, from your perspective, what does that mean? Did they miss one meal a day? Like, what does that exactly mean? How do you quantify it?
Food insecurity is defined as a household not being able to provide every family member consistent access to nutritious food. One of the things that the pandemic has really unearthed, which many of us knew was the case before the pandemic and has happened to, you know, become much more problematic, is the chronic rates of poverty and precarity that we have across the country. You know, we like to believe that we're sort of a middle-class kind of nation, but in the reality of it, the pandemic has revealed how many of us are so very close to falling into poverty. And so poverty is really the headlining narrative coming out of the pandemic, sort of unearthing that reality that families face every day.
So a couple weeks ago on The Confluence, we had leaders from Urban Farms in Pittsburgh on the show, and they explained how the produce that they were growing has become more needed than ever. What role do farms, either urban or rural, play in the solution to solving the issue of hunger?
You know, that direct connection and that growing of food in the community is important. And, you know, what comes out of an urban farm, what comes out of any farm, is more than just the produce produced out of that soil. It's also the, you know, community relationships that are built out of having that business or that community garden or that urban farm. Or, you know, larger scale farm in your community, you're part of the fabric of the community. So that brings foot traffic, that brings visitors, that, you know, creates a whole vibrancy around that place that is, you know, is also food.
Do you think that when we think about hunger, we think about it as only being an issue of like food to plate to mouth, but really it's a community-wide issue?
When you think of the word hunger, often people will think of sort of images of, you know, save the children, you know, these kinds of images. But, you know, hunger is a very complex issue, and it's rooted in a broader food system and an economic system. So, you know, rooted in hunger is larger issues of poverty. There's also just questions around our food supply chain. Currently, our food supply chain in this country is not designed with the, you know, nutritious, health-promoting diet for every resident, our food system is currently designed to produce as much food as cheaply as possible. And so while we have an abundance of food and we see, you know, there's actually a food waste problem in our country, there's an abundance of food. It's actually how it's distributed and what kind of food is being grown. What are the policies that are informing food growing? Who has access to supports to grow their systems? You know, we see a lot of inequities in our food system that I think the pandemic really highlighted.
There are a number of policies that came out to try to help address food insecurity and hunger during the pandemic. What are some policies that were kind of born from necessity in the pandemic that you hope carry on past the pandemic?
The primary policy change that I would lift up was the expansion of the SNAP benefit. The food stamp program is one of the most effective programs in the fight against hunger, essentially putting dollars in the pockets of low-income people to purchase food for themselves and their families, was expanded as part of the COVID response and is a expansion that we would advocate continue past the pandemic itself. The Farm to Families food box program. So you see boxes of fresh food being distributed throughout our region. We did some analysis of that program in our region. And, you know, while there was a real opportunity to help farmers get their food to market, because we were seeing that many producers, you know, with all of the closures, just didn't have access to markets. And so the idea of this program was to really help get that food directly to people who need it. You know, we're looking forward to participating in conversations to inform the direction of that program going forward.
Dawn Plummer is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Food Policy Council. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you so much for listening.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Each gas well that's fracked produces millions of gallons of salty wastewater. Often that brine is injected into disposal wells deep underground, but it doesn't always stay put. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a look at why.
There's a whole world under our feet, layers of earth, evidence of the natural history beneath parts of Ohio and Pennsylvania over hundreds of millions of years.
Things get wet, then they get dry. First they're lakes, and then they're deserts. That's our past, that's our future.
Tony Ingrafia is professor emeritus of engineering at Cornell University. Those lakes were salty water, and the mud and silt at the bottom were compressed over time into shale, a flaky but tightly packed rock. Meanwhile, on the surface, this region became more like a desert.
And what do you have in a desert? Sand.
Sand accumulated for many millions of years, creating a porous rock called sandstone. Then the cycle repeated again.
There was shale, then there was sandstone, then there's more shale, and then more sandstone. That's what happens over time.
Dead fish and plants caught in the shale layers eventually transformed into natural gas and oil. And the gas and oil can move from the shale into the sandstone layers. When people first started drilling for oil in the 1800s, they found it in the sandstone. In Pennsylvania, hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells have been drilled since then, tens of thousands in Ohio. But often, if they stopped producing, they were abandoned.
Pennsylvania and Ohio are the two states with the oldest wells and probably the highest density of wells, especially these really old wells.
Susan Brantley is professor of geosciences at Penn State University. Another type of well has become common, fracked shale wells. Drillers use millions of gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals at high pressure to crack the deeper, impermeable shale layers. This releases the oil and gas trapped in the Marcellus and Utica formations. And then salty wastewater called brine flows up to the surface.
Some people say the oil and gas industry, they should call it a water industry, because every oil and gas well brings up water with the oil and gas.
That chemical-laced wastewater can be toxic and radioactive, and disposing of it can mean another type of well, a disposal well, where wastewater is injected back into the earth. Pennsylvania has only 9 of these, with a handful more on the way. That leaves millions of gallons of Pennsylvania's waste that are trucked to Ohio's more than 200 disposal wells. Geologist Terry Engelder is professor emeritus at Penn State. He points out that with disposal wells, oil and gas wells, and older abandoned wells, there's a lot of holes in the ground.
When you have this many wells in the landscape, that makes the landscape Swiss cheese.
Engelder says that can be a problem when you're injecting wastewater underground. Liquid liquid at high pressure can move through spaces in the rock, and if it meets a well, it can rush up to the surface. This movement is called migration, and it's happened here already. Just last month, an unused gas well in southeastern Ohio started spewing brine water. The state collected more than 1.5 million gallons, but not before it killed fish and salamanders in a nearby creek. Engelder thinks the spray coming from that old well was wastewater that was injected into a nearby disposal well into the same sandstone layer.
It flowed along the Medina sandstone 2.54 miles and then back up.
In part to avoid this type of migration, disposal well operators in Ohio and Pennsylvania are required to identify and possibly plug abandoned wells up to a half-mile radius. But wastewater can travel much further than that. Cornell's Tony Ingraffia expects more wastewater to find its way to the surface.
Yes, because the more holes you drill in the ground, the higher the probability that the events that you're witnessing in Ohio are going to be repeating again and again.
I'm not really sure that you can say that there's so many wells that they're just going to start spewing all over the place.
Still, Penn State's Sue Brantley says while there are few accidents like this, when they do happen, they can create big problems. There are thousands of newer fracked shale wells, and Brantley's not sure how regulators can really prevent migration of wastewater.
How many people would you need with feet on the ground looking at this to really figure it out precisely when we cannot predict where a fracture is going to go?
Brantley says modern fracking in these ancient shale layers quickly took hold in the industry, but society is still learning the impacts of the waste it creates. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
Mr. Yuck is me.
For decades, parents have been trying to keep their young children from tasting household products that can be poisonous by placing ugly, menacing-looking Mr. Yuck stickers on the containers. The Pittsburgh Poison Center, the birthplace of Mr. Yuck, is marking his 50th birthday this week. Medical Director Dr. Michael Lynch joins us now. Welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Do you remember the Mr. Yuck stickers and the jingle even from when you were a kid?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a Pittsburgh native. I grew up in Monroeville, so I was very much aware of Mr. Yuck and the song, and we had him on a number of products around my house.
The now retired Dr. Richard Moriarty came up with the Mr. Yuck character when he was asked to create a poison control center. Was that a dual purpose, you know, quickly respond to poisonings, but also preventing kids from winding up in the hospital in the first place?
Absolutely. The role of poison centers, both in Pittsburgh and throughout the country, and Dr. Moriarty's vision for it, you know, certainly was to respond and make sure that we provided the best care possible. But our real goal, as in medicine in general, is to prevent illness and injury. And that is really the foundation of Mr. Yuck. If we never got another call because there was never a question of a poisoning emergency, then we'll have done our job perfectly. Unfortunately, realistically, that's not how the world works, but I do feel confident as we give away, you know, millions of Mr. Yuck stickers and magnets and informational items and things like that every year, that it must be having an impact.
About how many calls do you get, though? How many children do you treat or are able to direct parents to help their kids when they call?
Yeah, so last year, roughly 50,000 or so cases that we handled in the last year. Now, to be fair, about 20% of those were related to COVID, but of the other 40,000, almost half actually of our cases involve kids that are five and under, usually, you know, what we call exploratory ingestions, kids that get into things because they're laying around in the house.
Have the poison threats changed over the years, different products?
Yes, absolutely. There's no better example maybe than lead. You know, until about the time, you know, when I was growing up, you know, paint and gasoline, there was lead all over the place, and we came to understand that it was really dangerous. What we see tends to follow what the trends are in the world around us. And so, yeah, we have to continue to evolve with the times, with what's out there, both in our environment, chemicals, but also medications and drugs.
Have the typical household cleaning products become safer through the years and maybe even response to the potential danger through accidental poisonings?
I would say they definitely have, either from what is actually in the products, but also the packaging. You know, so things have childproof containers. A really common example of that would be laundry pods. There was a really big push, and you know, we see now on TV the commercials advertising their safe packaging to prevent those exposures.
People were stockpiling disinfectants and other cleaning products, especially early on when the virus's airborne transmission was less clear. Has there been a correlation between more chemicals in our homes, maybe during the pandemic, and accidental poisonings?
There has, both nationally and regionally. So, you know, from March 1st of 2020 to the end of February of this year, compared to the year before that, we saw a 65% increase in calls related to hand sanitizer exposures and an almost 50% increase in calls related to things like bleach and cleansers and other household disinfectants.
Is that a challenge? Because obviously parents wouldn't want their kids touching the bleach and the other disinfectant products, but I'm sure they wanted their children to use the hand sanitizers properly.
It is, right? And this this comes along with our job and responsibilities as parents, which are endless, I can say, as a parent. But in teaching how to use things and how to use them responsibly, that's part of what we do. Obviously, with young children, you have to be there and supervise it. But as kids get to be a bit older and independent, it really comes down to, and this is true pre-pandemic, but sitting down and being intentional about discussion about dangers and risks around you, and teaching them about, you know, proper ways to use things like hand sanitizer, what the dangers are. And if you're not sure, you can always call a poison center and just ask. You don't have to be poisoned. And that was actually a lot of the impetus for Mr. Yuck, was not just as a stop sign, so to speak, something to scare you away, but as an interesting, you know, image and figure that could be used as an education tool when you go to sit down with your kids and talk about what poisons are, to use the Mr. Yuck in that frame. And then when they see it later, they know what it means.
Finally, Dr. Lynch, what's your best performance of the Mr. Yuck jingle?
Oh, man. Well, I'm no singer, but I think the first couple phrases of the Mr. Yuck is mean, Mr. Yuck is green.
Home is full of lots of things that children shouldn't touch. Home is full of bad things that can hurt you very much. Now there's a man
Dr. Michael Lynch is the medical director for the Pittsburgh Poison Center, which is celebrating the 50th birthday of Mr. Yuck. Thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.